In the next hour, we've music and song with actress and singer Lisa Lam and her husband, baritone Simon Morgan. We have verse with Seamus O'Rourke, best known for his portrayal of rural Ireland in stories and plays. We have memories from the treasure trove that is the RTE archive with our own Angus McAnally and Owen Sweeney, and also a bit of timely advice to get us through the Christmas season with psychoanalyst Dr. Ray O'Neill. Now, I'm not sure if any of you have had time to read the papers today, but Mandy Johnson, writing in the Irish Independent, says that we should all put down the phones for Christmas, be present, give our full attention to the people around us rather than an inanimate object. And Seamus, you're going to start us off today on that very theme.
Yeah. Christmas 149. Christmas is all so modern now. They're full time on their phones. They have such smartphones, the young ones. It's all Wi-Fi and megabytes, hotspots, not Brussels sprouts. It's Snapchat and Instagram, sweet son of Bethlehem. It's magic. You can download Christmas on an app, keep the phone there on your lap during dinner, and listen for those message tones and Twitter tones and WhatsApp tones, and put that thing on silent tones, and then we'll FaceTime your sister before dessert. She'll be on the beach now down in Perth, getting ready for the Christmas swim. Pity she didn't learn to swim that good year we had when she was young. But thank God for the phone, especially today on Christmas Day. Brings them close when they're far away, not like our day, when you press button A, or was it B, scampering around looking for 5p. No, technology is great, so let them be. And what if their head's in another place? That's their age. Get off their case. Remember when we were 17, we had one phone in the hall, the only part of the house where there was no heat. Just the dark mahogany telephone seat that you reversed into when someone rang. Our house was 149. Ring, ring. There's the phone. Back then we had instant telephone recognition. Ring, ring. If it's Uncle John, I'm not at home. Mammy, it's Christmas Day. We're all at home. Well, think of something else to say, or he'll blather on for half the day. Ring, ring. Well, I'm not going. I answered it yesterday. Ring, ring. Well, I'm not going either. I'm staying here where it's nice and warm. Ring, ring. Mammy, the chocolates, the bottom layer is gone. Ring, ring. Will someone answer that goddamn thing? I'll go. Where's the blanket we use for answering phone calls? Ring, ring. Hello? And then we all cocked our ear. We didn't answer, but we liked to hear. Silence. OK, bye. Who was that? Aunt Kathleen. And what did she have to say? She said she cooked the turkey a different way this year, in a cooking bag. And? She said it was very moist. So she just rang up with that advice? No. She just said a quick hello and happy Christmas and love to all, because she knows our phone is in the hall where it's very cold. And that's all she had to say. Well, she said nobody should be left out in the cold on Christmas Day.
Well done, Seamus. Thank you very much. I have to tell our listeners at home that Lisa was on her phone at the start of that, and then she put it to the side, and then she moved it very far away from her. Is she bad on the phone, Simon?
She can be, indeed.
A social media queen. Yeah.
I tell you, that scarily reminded me of when I got married. I met Billy, my wife, in 1977, and we got married in 1979, and I was in a band in 1980, and I used to ring every night after every gig when I'd be away, because there were no mobile phones, and then you just brought that image back to me. And I remember one night in Carrick and Shore, playing in the Kick'em Inn, right? And I went down to the A&B black telephone, and what I would do is I'd ask for a reverse charge, because it saved trying to put all the coins in. So I'd reverse charge it to my house number, right? So I finished the gig, shake hands with everybody. I walked over to the phone, I rang the operator, said, hello, I wonder could I have reverse charges called to Dublin 846, and gave the number. And the voice said, how did the gig go, Angus? And it's just how did you know? Well, only said we don't get too many people looking for a reverse charges call to Dublin, and I recognised the numbers to kick him in, and I knew you were playing there. Isn't that a simple way of life?
And your wife's probably freezing in the hall while she's waiting for the phone call
with the roasting bag and putting the turkey in a different way this year.
But the phone thing is very real, though, isn't it, for everybody now? It is an addiction. Yeah. I'm talking about myself here.
It is because we it's a good tool to pick up when you're not sure what you're supposed to be doing. It's like lighting a cigarette years ago, when you could light a cigarette in public. But it's that something to have in your hand, and I do it myself. But
I was on the bus yesterday, on the top deck of the bus, and everybody was looking at their phones.
Yeah. Well, someone was saying to me the other day that they were in a place and they noticed that they'd been in doing a contract in a place, and every time they got into the elevator, if someone else was in there, as soon as you walked in, they took out their phone. It was like a nervous tick, because
so
otherwise
have
you
talk
might have
to, the
to
other
engage.
Yeah.
So it just became a thing you did, and they didn't even notice they were doing it. They were taking out their phone as soon as someone else appeared.
But I spent the last couple of months on tour, as you know, and we went for dinner one of the nights just in between the sound check and the show, and there are five of us sitting around this table. There's me, there's Ivan on piano, there's Denise on violin, and Maggie, who does the lighting, and Lucy, who does sound, right? And there was no sound, because all five of us were sitting looking at our phones, not saying a word to anybody.
Checking your
own
Twitter.
I think that happens when you're on the road. Like you, it becomes your lifeline to home, to sort of keeping up to date with everything. And I actually don't have Facebook, but I have Twitter and Instagram, and that's enough, I think, because otherwise I'd never get off the phone.
Plenty,
But I think it is when you're on the road. I used to come off tour and I'd be sitting in our sitting room and I'd realise, oh, Simon's actually here. I don't have to send him a message, you know.
Maybe we hide behind it. Maybe it's easier to say, I'm not really happy about what you've just been saying there, and send it in a text rather than going, excuse me, may I bring this up now?
Lisa and Simon, we're going to hear you perform, which I know will be magical, because I heard you doing an event very recently and it is wonderful. But how did you two meet? It's fascinating to watch you perform together.
Thank you very much. We met in the Gate Theatre, actually. We were both involved in a beautiful production of Sweeney Todd, directed by Selena Cartmell. It was a fantastic summer, actually. And, you know, I think that play actually brought us together. Our normal paths wouldn't have necessarily crossed, possibly might have at some point, but as an actor, singer, and Simon being a beautiful singer, it was how we kind of came together in the one place.
Yeah, it was a kind of high-risk strategy, because it was a three-month run and we got together during the rehearsal period. So had it worked out badly, it could have been
awful.
A very bad 3 months, particularly as we were playing a love interest on stage. So
But it is unusual, isn't it, that performers would be together in that way, because, you know, you generally have one great performer in the relationship. You might speak to this, Angus, you know?
Yeah, well, I mean, I met Billy, my wife, in the Abbey Theatre. I went in to play the Panto 40 years ago. And in fact, Reggie Lloyd, who's a bass player in a band I was working with, who still does extra work on Fair City, was responsible for me getting married, because I was playing in the Chariot Inn in Ranelagh, and I was working there every night, but I took a month off to rehearse and then play the Abbey Panto. And Reggie said to me on the first day that I was going in for rehearsal, he said, I've just finished doing a show in there. There's a board in there would suit you grand. She lives over the north side and has her own jam jar, her own car, right? Her name is Billy Morton. So I walked into the first day of rehearsal and I kept my ears, I said, and I waited until I heard someone saying, Billy, and I looked around, and almost, you know, that sort of cling that you see in the movies where the little shimmer. And I never knew what love was like until I met Billy. And it used to frustrate me when I heard people saying, what's it like to be in love? And they say, you'll know, right? Oh. I saw Billy and I went, OMG. I just thought this woman was fantastic.
Angus, and I hope she's listening.
Oh, I hope she's not. It cost me a fortune. No, but I saw her and I just thought, she's incredible. And I asked her 5 months later to marry me. And then we were such an unusual couple, because we're not what people would normally think would be a mix that would work together, that when I asked her to marry me and she said yes, and when I told people in May that we were getting married in June, they thought it was a shotgun, but actually it was the June of the following year. And 38 years later, we're still together.
Still,
and I love her dearly. She's brilliant. And she has been at my side all the way through. And I tell you what, and Simon and Lisa would know this so much, when you have somebody on your side, in your corner, on your team, in show business, by God, it's the most brilliant business in the world, and it's also the crappiest business in the world on occasions. All of your highs are out there, but also all of your lows are out there, and they are washed in public all the time. And it's lovely, and it's so fantastic to have somebody who loves you standing beside you going, this is going to be okay. And I strongly recommend it.
Okay, well, look, we're going to talk about relationships now again. And Owen, this is where you come in, because we're going to take a first listen to something from the archive. Tensions tend to get heightened in the house at Christmas.
They certainly do, don't they? Because we're all thrown back into our traditional roles or our place in the family pecking order, if you're 50, you're still the youngest, and you'll always be the youngest to your older siblings or however it might be, particularly if your parents are there and particularly if it's in the house you grew up in. But I suppose I've been digging into the archives, as you say, and some stuff is on the rt.ie/archives website, which I'll refer to shortly. But I suppose the first piece I've chosen is, as you say, what we also think of, I suppose, Christmas as being family, friends and food and all that good stuff, as Seamus was saying. It can also be a time for the odd flare-up, or as you'll hear in this piece, as John B. Keane would put it, the Yuletide outbreak.
People tend to behave too properly at Christmas, and where this happens, an outbreak of one kind or another is inevitable. So occasional verbal outbreaks are absolutely necessary. Thankfully, all Yuletide outbreaks, whether male or female, tend to be of short duration. They should be encouraged up to a certain point, however, for the good of the persons in question and for the good of the family as a whole. One of the most devastating Christmas rows ever to occur in the street where I was born happened a short while before the Christmas dinner. We shall call them Tom and Mary. Tom was sitting by the fire sipping from a glass of whiskey. Mary was sipping from a glass of sherry, as one was the wont with females at that time. "Will you have peas or beans with your turkey?" Mary asked politely. "It's immaterial to me," Tom responded with equal civility. "Make up your mind now, like a good man, for I haven't all day," said Mary, who had been up on the go since daybreak, attending to the myriad chores which needed her attention. "I really don't care one way or the other," Tom persisted. "Damn it," said Mary peevishly, "will you make up your bloody mind?" Whereat Tom told her what she could do with the peas and beans. Whereat Mary informed Tom that he was a thankless wretch. Whereat Tom smashed his glass against the floor, whereat they harangued each other without mercy and without let up for a quarter of an hour, whereat they both grew exhausted and fell into each other's arms, whereat all was peaceful again, and instead of having peas and beans, they had bought peas and beans together.
That was the great John B. Keane. Seamus, I could tell you were enjoying that.
Yeah, yeah. John B. was a great man to pick up the thoughts of the rural people and put it into words. But of course, Christmas is a time of great extremes. That's why these rows take place, and we overindulge, and that leads to an extreme on the other side. So for every positive, there's a huge negative somewhere along the line.
You're also spending a lot of time with people. You know, your busy life is suspended for a while.
Yeah, yeah, and nobody likes washing up. So
well, that's where the rows start. But look, to get some advice on all of that, I'm joined on the phone now by psychoanalyst Dr. Ray O'Neill, who you may know from the TV series Then Comes Marriage. Ray, you're very welcome to the programme. We're all expected to be magically happy and perfect at Christmas, but it doesn't always work out that way.
No, it's a bit like every Christmas. We're always looking under the tree, hoping Santa brings us something lovely, and that this year our brother or our sister or our partner will be really nice to us. And we never quite get the unwrapped gift that we always wanted. Every Christmas comes with its disappointments, and yet every year people look forward to it, whether as a family, whether as a couple, whether as an individual. And sometimes we just have to accept that we're going to be disappointed.
Mm-hmm. And a lot of those festering rows, some of them that have been bubbling away there in the background for years, tend to rear their heads at Christmas time, don't they?
Well, there is, because not every, like, oftentimes we imagine that we're spending Christmas with the people we want to spend Christmas with, but there's such social obligations to be with people, whether it's immediate family or in-laws or exes or estranged spouses, and you're in situations you really, really wouldn't choose. And then being Irish, we do the smartest thing possible in an awkward emotional situation, and we ply ourselves with alcohol. Just to make sure that everything cools off without a hitch.
Okay, so I would imagine your first piece of advice is to lay off the drink.
Just be mindful. Again, if you are in a situation that has the potential to be kind of in any way awkward or tense, I always say, because public transport's down on Christmas Day, possibly Stephen's Day as well, have an emergency exit. Bring your car, bring a vehicle that you can get out of. And once you drink, then you're stuck in the situation you're stuck in.
Okay. What else can we do then to mitigate against these pressures that you talk about?
I think, again, just going in with your eyes open. And again, that's all you can do is just like hope for the best and be the best and be gracious. But once that, you know, in any way temperatures start rising and they can't be diffused, don't become part of the problem. Just step away. Like someone said earlier on, there's always wash up to do. There's always another place, another part of the house you can go to. But just be mindful of the situation just accelerating.
What can we do, though, to, because you spoke at the beginning about the expectation that we're all going to have a great time and that we are almost inevitably, some people are inevitably disappointed when it doesn't live up to expectations. Is there a way that we can manage those expectations in the lead up to Christmas?
I think one of the things, especially for people indeed that possibly haven't families or indeed are on their own, whether that's because they're single or whether it's because they're elderly, or particularly those that have gone through a bereavement in the last year. Like, we sang with Band Aid about Do They Know It's Christmas, but for too many of us, we actually unbearably know that it's Christmas. And you feel so excluded because you're not gathered around the Hallmark fire, singing carols and raising glasses of port with your nearest and dearest. So one of the best things to do is just look after yourself. Make sure that you do something on the day that just honours you and your life and something that you enjoy, whether that's a gift, whether that's chocolates, whether it's meeting a friend.
Buy yourself something, you're saying.
Yeah,
I like that idea.
You know, doesn't arrive or doesn't bring you exactly what you want. You know what? In life, sometimes happiness and kindness starts at the home that is your own self.
We were talking to Father Simon Sleeman in the previous hour about change and rebirth. Are you in favour of ringing the changes at this time of the year too?
I suppose I'm in favour of ringing in the changes any time of the year, as long as people follow through. And I suppose after Christmas comes New Year, which again is another flashpoint for different people for different reasons. And I always say, look, make one change. Like, it's worth your while, like, whatever optimism or whatever hopes or whatever it is you want for Christmas, after Christmas, look back and kind of go, well, look, how much did I put into what people, whether that's financially, whether that's emotionally, whether it's in terms of time, and what did I get back out of the situation? So that you're not doing the exact same thing next year.
Okay, so if something didn't work out for you, change it.
Yeah, and only you can change it. I mean, this is what we do, whether it's in couples or in relationships or in families. Like, again, if like someone said earlier on, if you're the youngest, you'll always be the youngest in the family. If you're waiting for other people to change, I think after 20, 40 or 60 years and they haven't changed, they're not going to. Mm-hmm. Well, you can. And it doesn't have to be in any way dramatic. It doesn't have to be extreme. It can often just be being kind to yourself.
I'm wondering, is there anyone around the table who does not enjoy Christmas? Angus, hand up straight away. Really?
Yeah, it's something weird. I'd love to ask Ray about two aspects of it, if I may. One is, I'm a non-drinker and have been for, excuse me, for the best part of 40 years now. And I find it's a very lonely place on occasions when you're the only person who's not drinking. And I try to bite my lip a lot of the time. I love being with people having fun. I love my family having fun. And we all drink, they all drink. I love that, right? But when it gets messy out in social situations, and I would have a tendency to say, well, maybe we'll leave it there now, that's enough for a grand or whatever. And it can backfire on you. And there can be angst there, both among family or among friends or among colleagues or whatever. And I just wonder, am I better just, what I tend to do is just exit stage left quietly and say nothing to them. That's one thing. So the difficulty of being a non-drinker at a festive time. And the other thing, right, is that I don't know where this comes from, but every kind of, once you get into the end of November, start of December, I start to get twitchy. And a couple of times, and it's a failing in me, and I love my family, I love my kids, I love my grandchildren, I love the whole notion of Christmas on one level, but I could quite happily tonight go asleep and wake up on the 27th and say, that's grand, it's all over, we can move on.
What is it that you don't like?
I don't know, and I wish I could find out.
Ray would find out for you. He's sat down with you for a while.
And Billy has said to me, look, I know this is not an act. I know you're not just being a knockered old fecker, that there is something deep rooted there. And I've no notion of something that happened either in my youth or in my teens or whatever, but I get unsettled. I don't find it a very happy, embarrassed to say that, but I don't find it a happy time.
Some people just don't like Christmas, Ray. That's fair enough, isn't it?
Absolutely. I mean, there's a reason why we watch movies about the Grinch and Scrooge. At some level, we want to honour the people that don't get lost in the festive mood. One of the things, and particularly say with a lot of the couples that actually did go ahead and get married from the TV show, was they were talking with myself and Alison afterwards about how many of them didn't actually get to enjoy the day, having spent months, possibly years, looking forward to it. they didn't get to enjoy it because there was just too much pressure. And again, Christmas is like an annual pressurized zone in terms of finances, in terms of emotions. One of the cute couples, who I'm sure won't mind me sharing this bit of advice, they did something adorable. On their wedding, they made a plan that every hour they just took a few minutes to themselves to just meet somewhere, whether it was at the bathroom, whether it was outside, and just to check in with themselves, how are you doing? Sometimes over Christmas, it's good to actually just check in with somebody, whether it's a spouse, partner, whether it's a child, whether a grandchild or a friend or neighbour, how are you doing? It just... it's a moment of sanity, a moment of clarity in the middle of the madness.
Mm-hmm.
And just in terms of what Angus is saying, there is such ridiculous pressure around alcohol in Ireland. And if you don't participate, people will assume you're pregnant, even if you're male. I often get that from people who are just like, how come you're not drinking? There must be something wrong with you.
Yeah, yeah.
So, yeah. I use the car as a great excuse because I always just kind of go, look, no, I'm driving, so no, thanks very much. And again, like I say, it is a perfect exit. If things do get a little bit messy or a little bit heated, you're like, oh, cheekers, look, I have to head on. And, you know, just do your best. Mm. I think Angus's strategy of exiting as quietly as possible is always the best strategy.
Now, I'm wondering, do our singers, do you drink? Because you're a baritone, you look after your voice. Does it?
Yeah. Well, I certainly do partake. I mean, I guess at Christmas is quite a busy time, but it's interesting when we're talking about the pressures and actually sitting beside my wife, it feels like an intervention at some of your advice there. And next year I will be better and buy the presents before Christmas Eve. But genuinely, the Christmas spirit and everything that's great about Christmas for me is often in what luckily for me is the work beforehand, like the concerts and the singing with people and, you know, getting a whole room full of people singing in spirit where there is no ulterior motive as such. You know, they're the moments that are most precious. And, you know, luckily enough, sometimes the family will come in and they're the great family moments in many, many ways, even though they're in a public forum, so to speak. But they're the moments that mean so much and probably mean one of the reasons I like Christmas so much, because you're out with people for the joy of music, and for me, that's what's really precious about Christmas, as opposed to the gifts and that side of things.
Well, we're going to share in one of those precious moments now. We're going to ask you to head over to our microphones and prepare to sing, Lisa and Simon. While you're doing that, Owen, you have another piece of archive for us, our Santa letter.
Yes, this is from the RTE Archives website, which I urge everyone to check out online. It's a terrific treasure trove, as you said earlier. This little clip is from 1967. It's called Dear Santa, I Hope You Are Well. It's from the Newsbeat programme that year, and you'll hear in this the voiceover of Frank Hall and a young unidentified girl discussing what she'd like for Christmas.
Dear Santa, I hope you are well. For Christmas, I would like a selection box, a doll's clothes, surprises in box, I forgot that one, surprises in boxes, telephone set, and a big teddy bear. And I think that was all. And the rest one in the box will be surprises.
What are what are surprises in boxes?
They're things that you don't know what they are.
Mm.
Well, I used to never get them. I used to get a few, but I never had them in boxes.
Mm.
I said and boxes. I said it should have said in boxes.
Mm. And will he bring you what you asked for, do you think?
I think he will. Mm. I don't know exactly. He might or he mightn't. Well, some Christmases I get what I want, and some Christmases I don't. Well, I'm not disappointed. I'm glad to get any. It's better to get any than none.
I was Dear Santa, the voice of Frank Hall there, with a child who was very sure about what she wanted for Christmas from 1967. My thanks also to Dr. Ray O'Neill, who joined us just a moment ago with all of that great advice for relationships and how to manage the pressures of Christmas time. Now, Lisa Lam and Simon Morgan are about to perform for us. Nigel Linden is accompanying them on keyboard. It's over to you.
Thank you. Can't stay.
But baby, it's cold outside.
I've got to go away.
But baby, it's cold outside.
This evening has been
hoping that you
so
drop
very
in.
Now
I'll take your hand, they're just like
my eyes. Mother will start to worry.
Beautiful, what's your
My father
hurry?
Will be pacing the floor.
Listen to that fireplace
So
roar.
Really I'd better scurry.
Beautiful, what's your
well, maybe
hurry?
Just a half a sip more.
Put some records on while I pour.
The neighbors might think.
But baby, it's bad out there.
Say, what's in this street?
No cabs to be had out there.
I wish I knew how.
You're out of luck star
to
right
break
now.
The spell.
I'll take your hat. Your hair looks swell.
I have to say no, no, no,
mind
sir.
Mind if I move in closer?
At least I'm gonna say that I tried.
What's the sense in hurting
I
my pride?
I really can't stay.
Baby, don't hold out.
Oh, but it's cold outside.
Out there.
Say, lend me your coat.
It's up to your knees out there.
You've really been grand.
I thrill when you touch my
hand.
But
don't you see?
How can you do this thing to
me? There's bound to be talk tomorrow.
Think of my lifelong sorrow.
At least
sorrow.
There's gonna be plenty implied.
If you caught pneumonia
I
and die.
I really can't stay.
Baby, don't hold out.
Oh, but it's cold outside. Baby, it's cold outside. Merry Christmas, baby.
Told you it was special. Lisa Lam, Simon Morgan and Nigel Linden on keyboard, and we'll have more for them later on in the show. Gosh, it beats talking about politics, I'll tell you that. Seamus O'Rourke after this break. Okay, Seamus O'Rourke, we want to hear from you again now. This is called The Girl in the Church. Do you want to tell us a bit about this or do you want to go straight into it?
Well, it's a kind of self-explanatory.
I'll go on then.
It'll show my age. The Girl in the Church, Part 1. It was the winter of 1980. That year and season were innocent times, a time when everyone believed in something. It was Christmas in Dromila. What went on elsewhere didn't matter. We seemed to have spent the week in the church praying and confessing and praying again. I was 15 and was having nothing but bad thoughts. I had been suffering from bad thoughts for a while now, and God was out to get me if I didn't start thinking of something other than girls. The girls I thought about were all in my head and weren't wearing very much. The Dromila girls were all covered in cardigans, layers and layers of cardigans wrapped round them several times. Not a bit point chatting them up, said Mickey Lee. You'd have one knit as quick. Mickey Lee had been with this Galway girl the year before when he went to see the Pope in Knock. That day the Pope's mass was held up because the crowd started singing He's Got the Whole World in His Hand. Mickey Lee thought the song was about him. I was more of a romantic. I loved Christmas films with Bing Crosby and Frank Sinatra, musicals where they got the girls, sang to them and then kissed the daylights out of them while music played in the background. I had tried this approach on a girl from Drumreilly. We were out the back of Drumleigh Hall one frosty night a few weeks earlier. I couldn't wait to get to the low bit of White Christmas, but the poor girl had buttoned up her cardigan and bolted long before I got to the low bit. As I walked into Dromila Church for midnight mass that year, I sensed the strangeness about the place. There was something different, something new. There was a presence, and it was a girl, a young woman from Dublin. She had taken up residence on the woman's side. I knelt close to the back door so that I could reserve the minor indulgence of looking over for later. And she wore perfume. Perfume as opposed to Lifebuoy soap. I could smell it halfway down the chapel because I could distinguish every smell in that chapel, every smell, every sound, every cough, every footstep, every hat, every scarf, every head, every genuflect, every kine, every and also with you. I glanced to my left, but God had put Mrs. Boyle, the biggest woman in South Leitrim, in my line of vision. But I knew she was lovely. Not Mrs. Boyle, the girl in the church. I knew she was lovely because Mickey Lee was sitting four rows in front of me with his mouth open, just staring over at her. Mrs. Boyle eventually slid over a bit during the readings as I got a glimpse of the girl. Her short dark hair, her perfect skin, how I longed for communion time when her true beauty would be unveiled. I'd hold out to see if she went up to receive, and if not, I'd go up with my big, I think I looked like Johnny Logan head on me. She'd have to notice that. But then she raised herself calmly, gracefully and reverently. She walked up the Mila Chapel. The choir sang Holy Night, and she was tall, like real tall. That disqualified most of the opposition, except Mickey Lee. He was tall too. She walked in slow motion to the altar as she would on our wedding day. Well, if her front was half as good as her back. She received the Eucharist, blessed herself, bowed slightly and turned. End of
and
part
that's
one.
Part one. We'll get the rest of the story before the end of the programme. Seamus, people love to see you perform. Are you taking a break now for Christmas, and where can they see you after Christmas?
I have a very short break at Christmas, and then I start rehearsing my new play, which is called From Under the Bed, and we're opening in the Viking in Clontarf on the 29th of January, and then we head to the Dolmen, and then we're in the Helix and the Pavilion out in Dunleary, and then take a little break, and we're back after Easter with a 5-week tour with that, and it's myself and Arthur Reardon, and it's directed by Barbara McQueeve. So
it's all flying for you, isn't it? It really is going well.
Yeah, it's I kind of I'm only full time in the business for the last 6 years, and I kind of decided at the time that rather than sitting waiting for work to come to me, I decided to make my own work. So I'm a bit like the travelling shop, and I put everything into the van and head off, and I tour all the time. So
yeah, because you had a completely different life up to your mid 40s, and then
I started off as a carpenter, left school when I was 15, shortly after I met the girl in the church. No. you have to wait for the end of that story. Yeah, so I had a very different life, and there's hope for everybody. I'm now doing what I love to do.
Big leap of faith, though, isn't it?
To take that decision. Yeah, but my kids were kind of half grown up, and
Seamus has an extraordinary talent for a couple of reasons. I think he has managed to capture brilliance in theatre and in art, but also is a social historian who's actually documenting a time in a way that John B did 20, 30 years ago. I think Seamus is doing that now in the stuff that he writes. He's capturing the reality of Ireland today and Ireland over the last 10 or 15, 20
years. No,
I'm serious. And also then with an incredible ability to deliver the lines. So I think you've all the bits. You tick all of the boxes. Fantastic
but
talent.
Yeah, the strange thing is, though, what I've set out to do, I suppose, in a way, is to bring theatre to people who wouldn't normally go. And there's a lot of, especially rural people, who are a little bit afraid, thinking that it's a little bit too deep, it's a little bit too heavy, and it's a bit like walking a plank out on, or walking on a cliff edge, and they don't want to go out there, whereas I feel like I'm just creating a little handrail that they could maybe hold on to. There's a bit of humour, there's a bit of something that they can grasp, and so
you get the depth but you get the laugh.
Yeah. Exactly. And someone said to me recently, how come a few theatre managers said to me, you know, very strange thing happening with your shows, there are men now ringing to book up, because, you know, Angus will know this, that a lot of the people who are going to theatre now, people are older females, because I don't know for what reason. I think it's, you know, men are a bit afraid that they're going to be brought
to something
you know, that they might have to, you know, they might have to invest too much in, and just a little bit afraid of it. So it's lovely to hear that those people are coming to the shows. And
it's wonderful, though, that there is now a proper circuit of little 200 and 250 seat theatres all over the country, intimate theatres everywhere. Yeah. So the opportunity for people to go to theatre, to music, is there. It's wonderful. And it wasn't there before.
The thing we have to get right when we're touring, like a lot of people spend 6 weeks filling out forms to get applying for arts funding, but I'm working on the basis that I've something that I think people will go to, so therefore I'm taking a chance on being able to make a few quid myself, and I don't have to go cap in hand to the Arts Council, which is which is good. Of course, some people turn their nose up at that and say, well, you must be doing something very common if people are going to see it.
I love it.
Oh, and back to you now, because another person, of course, who was brilliant at drawing characters was Maeve Binchy, and you have an archive clip from Maeve.
Indeed, this is from the RTÉ radio archives, and it's Maeve Binchy. It's social history, as Angus pointed out there. Here she is talking about, I suppose, a list of characters that would frequent her childhood home on Christmas Day, and also how the arrival of television changed things.
And my mother used to have this great statement she used to announce to us the whole time. She used to say very firmly, you see, we're happy 364 days of the year. Now, I wasn't entirely sure that I agreed with her, because no child, especially a 15 or 16, feels that she's happy 364 days of the year. And the reason my mother used to say this very purposefully was because she wanted us to share Christmas Day with other people. So as far as I was concerned, Christmas Day was always a day when the most unlikely people descended on our house. And we weren't great entertainers. My parents never gave dinner parties, and the word cocktail party was never heard of in our house. But on Christmas Day, the house always was full of people, and the most extraordinary people. There was a woman who came there. She was a single lady, and her sister had died. And after her sister died, my mother insisted in inviting her to come and have Christmas Day. Her name was Miss Hat, simply because she wore a hat the whole time, morning, noon and night. And Miss Hat had a notion that there was a man who had intentions towards her. And then there was a lady who was a retired school teacher from England, and she was used to always have this extraordinary expression, I better not have a glass of sherry, she used to say, or I'll talk about my poor relations. Now, we thought her relations were in a dungeon or something, tied up somewhere. It was very interesting. But apparently that's a kind of an expression, that if you have too much to drink, it loosens your tongue and you talk about people who aren't as well off as the people you'd be talking about otherwise. And then there was another man who was a gardener in the neighbourhood, and he came and he mainly talked about mulch and digging things up. And it wasn't what you'd call the easiest of social mixes, but we were so sure in the conviction that we were happy 364 days in the year, we put up with it. And then the most marvellous thing happened. Television was invented, and they all went to sleep. They all went to sleep at 4 o'clock, and they woke up at 6:30, and they said it was the best Christmas they ever had. They had tea and tomato sandwiches and went home.
Maeve Binchy, just never tire of listening to Maeve. Now, after the break, we're going to hear part two of The Girl in the Church. Seamus, really looking forward to that, and we're going to hear more from Simon and Lisa. What's coming up for you guys in the new year?
Well, it's exciting times, isn't it, Simon?
Yeah, well,
exciting times.
I've been working for about 10 years actually on a project. It's Thomas More reimagined. He was a great poet, obviously, and between himself and William Bunting at the end of the 18th century, they kind of kept the Irish. The reason we have so many great traditional tunes is because of the work they did. But his lyrics are amazing, and people can kind of have, because they were all over the place, you know, 50 years ago, they bred a bit of contempt, but actually at the time they were amazing. And also because there's rhyming couplets, people tend to think that it's maybe not great art, but his lyrics are unbelievable. And I guess I've been working with a number of musicians, trad musicians, and people like Carl Nesbitt, and jazz musicians, and Drajan Derek, and indeed Nigel, and many different people, on kind of reimagining them for contemporary Ireland. So the lyrics are used, and traditionalists won't be disappointed in that the melodies are still there, but we've made some of them into salsas, and we've made some of them into jazz pieces and folk tunes. And I mean, the lyrics are as appropriate now as two centuries ago. If you'll allow me, I just was thinking there during the break, or when I'm listening to this beautiful poetry being read out, just one of the verses, and it's something that could really make your Christmas, maybe, Angus, is it?
Yeah, I'm up for it.
Come send round the wine and leave points of belief to simpleton sages and reasoning fools. This moment's a flower too rare and brief to be withered and stained by the dust of the schools. Your glass may be purple and mine may be blue, but while they're both filled from the same bright bowl, the fool that would quarrel for difference of hue deserves not the comfort they shed o'er the soul. So everyone can live together. It doesn't matter. And sometimes in a 180 character world, everything's a bit too black and white.
Okay, and More Reawakened is coming to the National Concert Hall in February.
February the 21st, National Concert Hall.
Well,
yeah.
It sounds as though it's going to be fantastic. And Lisa, briefly, you're going to be on stage.
On stage, yes. Well, 2017 was a very exciting year. One of the highlights was Jimmy's Hall at the Abbey's Theatre for me. And I worked with the wonderful Graeme McLaren. And we're coming back with that next year, but also The Unmanageable Sisters with Graeme McLaren. An adaptation by the wonderful Deirdre Kinahan is coming, and it's opening February 26th at the Abbey Theatre.
A busy new year for you both. Let's take that break and back with more after this. We've all been dying to hear what happened with the girl in the church. Say, Seamus, will you tell us?
The girl in the church turned, her head slightly bowed. I thought I heard a drum roll as the moment of truth arrived. But it wasn't a drum roll, it was Mrs. Boyle reversing back her pew, preparing for takeoff. And before I could get a proper look at my future bride, off Mrs. Boyle went up the aisle, and Mickey Lee after her. God was playing games. The girl in the church was nowhere to be seen until she sidestepped the stampede, and then, for the first time, I laid eyes on the most beautiful creature that ever walked into Dromila. She was Annie Lennox, she was Sinead O'Connor, she was Sally O'Brien, and the way she might look at you. She was Audrey Hepburn, Mae West, Doris Day, Marilyn Monroe. She was the one on the telly who said, RTE on Shahagath. And more importantly, she was here, and I could see her, and Mickey Lee couldn't, because he was behind Mrs. Boyle on the way back down from the altar. And she was beautiful, not Mrs. Boyle, the girl in the church. After Mass, we stood out the back of the chapel. The girl from the church broke with all tradition and left via the men's side. And as she passed, she smiled, a sort of, how are you now, smile. Like we had already committed to a long and lasting relationship. I felt my cheeks go red, so did hers, so did Mickey Lee's. But I had seen her first. And she was mine. Someone said the girl from the church was staying with her cousin close by, staying until the new year, and so Newtown Gore was the direction I would face when I stood outside my own house later on that night, the perfect distance to admire her, to croon her, and I did that night. Christmas Eve night, still in my good mass clothes, and I was Bing Crosby, almost hitting the low notes of White Christmas. And may all your Christmases be white.
Thank you, Seamus. Poor, poor Mrs. Boyle. She got an awful doing in that.
Hello, is that Claire Byrne? This is Mrs. Boyle here. I'd like to see that man. Excuse me, I want to see him now. My solicitor will be on to you in the morning.
Thank you, Angus. Okay, we're now going to hear from Lisa Lam and Simon Morgan again, and Nigel, of course, on keyboards.
Silent night, holy night, all is calm, all is bright, round yon virgin mother and child. So tender and mild, sleep in heavenly peace, sleep in heavenly peace.
So
Rhodes would have stunned into silence here. Lisa Lam and Simon Morgan, possibly the most talented couple in Ireland. Thank you so much for being with us here today. Father Simon Sleeman was in touch with us to say that the Glenstall Abbey services will be streamed on their website live on Christmas Day, so that might be a nice thing to do. I just want to thank all of my guests today. Aingus McAnally, you're on the radio tonight. Late date tonight,
yeah, and in with Joe Duffy tomorrow from 9am in Grafton Street for the annual Christmas Eve night.
Will you ever take morning. A rest? Take a rest at some point. Get the head down. I know you don't like Christmas, but you know... Go to sleep for a day or something,
and
Aingus.
It'll be all over. Thank you.
Seamus O'Rourke, many thanks to you and good luck with the new play in Cheers. The new year. I know people will be really excited to go along and see that. Owen, thank you for bringing us the archive material today. Again, to Simon and Lisa, thank you very much. And happy Christmas to you both. And to Nigel Linden on keyboard. Thank you very much, Nigel. The show was produced today by Anne Farrell. The research was by Leslie Anderson. And broadcast coordinator is David Phelan. Cara O'Hare was very busy on sound. So thank you to Cara. The music you're hearing is the wonderful brass quintet from the RTE Concert Orchestra. So all that's left for me to do now is to wish you all a very happy Christmas, and we will chat again in the new year.